BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Back in April, the Supreme Court decided that a woman is defined by biological sex under equalities law. The effect of this decision would be that sex-based protection under the law would only be available to people who were born female. Well, this is being interpreted as meaning that those who have gender reassignment certificates but were not born female would lose legal protection on the basis of gender in single-sex safe spaces. Well, campaigners against the previous legal position welcome this decision, but we've heard from Natalie, a blind trans woman, who feels that one aspect of this controversy which has been largely overlooked is the effect of such a decision on disabled people, and in particular in her case as a blind woman. It's not our intention here to rerun the whole debate on which this court case was based. That's been done and continues to be done in other more appropriate spaces. But to hear Natalie's story and what she feels could be the effect on her and other blind people's safety and the ability to take part fully in public life on an equal and safe basis. Natalie, welcome. First of all, just explain your situation in terms both of your sight and your gender assignment.
I've been totally blind for pretty much all my life. That's relatively straightforward. My gender identity, so I identify as female, as a woman. My pronouns are she and her. I have known this to be the case for a very long time, since I was a child, but I've only really come out and been living properly in my assigned gender for about 2.5-3 years.
So just to be clear about this, you were born male. At what point did you come to believe that, as far as you were concerned, you were a girl?
So right from a very early age, really. So the concept of being born as one thing is an interesting point, because I guess I was assigned male. And when you are assigned your sex at birth, that's done by a doctor having a quick look at what's going on with your body and making a decision. In 97% or 98% of cases, they'll be correct. But that doesn't really make allowance for kind of who people are. And the moment your sex is declared, a sort of social gendering process starts. So if you are a boy, you have blue things, because currently that's what we think is a thing for boys. And you are supposed to, like, I don't know, running around or whatever. And there are just many more subtle ways. Adverts for boys' toys are angry, loud, fast, hectic. And that sort of feeds in, I guess, to a child's kind of socialized gender, if you like. I was uncomfortable with that from a very young age. I remember being uncomfortable with certain elements of my body. Certainly through primary school, there were certain things I felt, but I never knew the words. I was at school during a piece of legislation called Section 28 of the Local Government Act, and that prohibited the teaching of anything other than heterosexual relationships in schools. And although that didn't affect me per se, its secondary effect was that gender identities, which weren't as well understood, weren't really discussed. And it was only when I was about 11 or 12, I remember saying explicitly, I wish I was a girl. That's the first time I vocalized it sort of to other people.
And how did those around you react to this?
Badly, in a word. My family were quite vocally dismissive. I guess the sadness was that nobody asked any questions. It was just a weird thing. I was just being strange. I had just said a comical, ridiculous thing, as if I'd said, when I grow up, please can I be the moon or something, you know? Like, there was no understanding, no empathy. And that was quite a traumatic experience, that immediate visceral shooting down of this thing that had already taken me 7-8 years to express.
And can I get you to say a little bit about the relationship between that and the fact that you were blind? You know, were there practical difficulties for you in understanding what was happening and what to do about it?
There were, yeah, there were practical difficulties all the way through. A lot of the anti-trans propaganda would have us believe that society makes people trans and that young people now are coming out as trans because the media is full of liberal trans positive ideology. But actually, as I said, I was at school during Section 28, so I wasn't allowed to learn anything about alternate sexual orientations or gender identities at school. My family shut conversations down brutally and finally, so I wasn't able to get any advice and support at home. As a blind child, I wasn't able to sort of find information by sort of sneakily picking up leaflets at doctor surgeries or at events or whatever. I couldn't see any sort of gender positive role models. The only media I had access to easily was the mainstream media telling me that essentially how I felt was synonymous with naughty men who did mean things to children in toilets, which is categorically untrue in all senses. I did have access to the internet, but even then I was frightened of searching. I wasn't taught the words to look for to understand myself.
So you're saying the information was out there, but a lot of it was visual and therefore you couldn't get at it, really?
Exactly, yes. It was something it was a journey I couldn't make on my own. There are a number of memoirs of trans people who are similar ages to me, and they talk about this. They talk about all this media out there, and I resent them heartily for having access to it.
Right. So people like David Bowie, for example, how he dressed, how he presented himself, this was out there, but it wasn't. You just had the music, basically.
Absolutely, yeah. And the music is splendid, but David Bowie is kind of a queer icon. Brett Anderson from the band Suede, Brian Malko, I think his name is, from the band Placebo, who expressed themselves, all the goths and the new romantics from the 80s, you know, were cultural influences, really, that would have helped me to just feel comfortable. And it wouldn't have changed my mind, because what I really want to reiterate to anybody questioning is the simple fact that even without all this stuff, even with all lines of inquiry being closed down, I haven't changed my mind in 30 years, 35 years, however long it's been, you know, since I really manifested that.
Right. So what is it that you say will be the effect of this change in the law on your life from a purely personal point of view?
I think there are three things that I'm worried about. One is what it allows people to do. Technically speaking, the laws haven't changed insofar as there has been a clarification to the Equality Act, but the Equality Act itself hasn't changed. But it's how that was responded to, because the response became this huge avalanche of trans-exclusionary propaganda and policy and guidance, which gave carte blanche for people to hate. And if people feel empowered to hate and to express this negativity, then that just makes you more vulnerable on the street. The second effect is the exclusionary impact of these changing policies, this guidance which claims that it is now apparently clear and easy who should go where in terms of public spaces. That isn't the case. The way that I am at the moment, the way that I look, the way I present myself, the way my body is changing based on the elements of medical transition I'm choosing to undergo, makes me fairly evidently female to all intents and purposes, and indeed a woman to all intents and purposes.
So you're talking about the clothes that you wear, the way you present yourself?
Yeah, the way that I present myself, my clothes, my hair, certain changes resulting to sort of the hormones I'm taking as part of my transition. It's pretty obvious who I am. And so that means that if I were to go into men's spaces, I guess if we take this to the toilets, though, will someone please think of the toilets? If I'm lucky, I would be awkwardly ignored, but I'm most likely to be told, you're in the wrong loos, love. And then what? Do I say, oh no, I'm trans? There's at least five different pieces of legislation that protect my right to privacy as a trans person. And so coming out to a random man in the toilets is really not quite what I had in mind. And then, of course, there's the simple threat of violence wherever I go, whether I go into a men's or a women's private space. If I go into a man's space and I'm victimized, kind of because I'm perceived as a woman or as a trans person or as a gay person or as whatever they choose to label me as, then I could be a victim of physical verbal assault, which apparently I'm still protected against. If I go into a woman's space and someone take exception to this, then I am some form of predator because I need to try on a dress or go to the toilet. Like, where do I go? Yes, I can use the accessible loos, but telling me I should go there just as a disabled person means I'm being excluded as a disabled person from society. And that's well beyond the remit of any of these changes.
And this brings us to, I think, the point that made you contact us, that you feel, as a blind person, at greater risk from these things. Can you just spell out why you think that?
Well, I mean, as blind people, I think we're already aware of the extra care we have to take. We can't see the risks around us, whether that's being extra careful when we cross roads, especially with, you know, electric cars, as an example. We have to take more care. But when you're walking alone as a woman, you feel more vulnerable because you are, you know, perceived as a woman, which carries its own vulnerability. And when you can't see the risks around you, you either don't know that they're there or you can't as easily escape from that situation. You have to interact with people more. I talk about waiting for taxis. I have to trust that the person who's going to take me, you know, come and collect me and take me to a taxi, I have to trust that they are, in fact, a taxi driver. And it's something you didn't necessarily think about. What if they're not? And maybe I'm, of course, I'm overreacting to a certain extent, but actually there are some really quite vitriolic people out there and it is quite frightening. So I think it's just the extra risk assessment you have to do and the inability to extricate yourself as easily and independently as a blind person that really does exacerbate, you know, can make a situation much worse.
Is this changing your behaviour? Are there things you're not doing now that you would have done before?
Yeah, definitely. I'm certainly not going out to certain events. I find myself more anxious when I do go out. I'm having to think about sort of maybe going out for like shorter periods of time so I can come home to go to the loo. There's an element, I guess, of defiance in the trans community, but that only gets you so far.
I mean, presumably up until now, you have been using so-called safe spaces for women. Do you have any direct evidence that using specifically male spaces will expose you to risk or offensive behaviour, or for that matter, female safe spaces?
I hear more about people being challenged in female spaces, actually. But the problem there, I think, with other disabilities is that it's not often trans women who are challenged in female spaces. It's people whose bodies don't conform to what people decide women should look like. So people who are sort of presenting as kind of more sort of a, from a butch lesbian subculture, just people who have larger frames, taller bodies, most of whom, nearly all of them, are cis women. So women who, you know, were assigned female at birth and are still identifying as women. So it's the fact that this is just affecting women anyway. Like, this isn't saving anyone. I don't, to be fair, have direct experience at the moment.
Is that because you're avoiding?
Because I'm avoiding spaces. And also the times before this ruling, I have never had a problem. No one ever challenged me. I never felt challenged. I never felt unsafe. I never encountered anyone being a predator. There are many stories, however, of trans women from some time ago and maybe in the US more being horrifically treated because they went into male spaces and identified as trans.
Won't blind and partially sighted women be justified in arguing that they were under the same increased risk for the same kinds of reasons that you've explained, i.e. their increased vulnerability because of their lack of sight, if people born as biologically male continue to use female safe spaces?
I think I would ask them for the evidence of that. So there is one case that is held up as a high-profile example of a trans woman who, before she transitioned, I believe it was, committed some sexual assaults. Now, there is no justification for that. There is no sense that that is a good or a right thing. But what I would say is, in the wake of the Lucy Letby court case, are we saying that no women should be nurses? We're not, because that would be evidently absurd. So why are we saying that all trans women are predators? Because one person who was reprehensible and is punished as a result did a bad thing. And there is absolutely, categorically no evidence of trans women representing any harm. If anything, I think the statistics of trans women experiencing abuse are slightly higher than among cis women, although it's not a competition, it's not a good thing.
I think that you too didn't want to rerun the debate on this programme about who should use what facilities and about, you know, what has happened in the law. But what is it you really want people to understand about your situation that you feel they don't at the moment? And that includes the fact that you're blind.
What I want people to understand is that transness might seem new, but it isn't. And that there are evidences of gender crossing, gender fluid, gender challenging communities all throughout history. And that there have been disabled people all throughout history. And both of those histories are hidden and are becoming more evident now as history is explored in different ways. And I want to talk about the commonalities in experience. So as a trans person, I have to answer questions, invasive questions about surgeries or medical treatments or about legal points or about bureaucratic points or about philosophical points. I'm supposed to be an expert in all of these things. And as blind people, we'll be aware of that sense of having to be experts in our conditions because there is a huge lack of knowledge in society. And I think it's about that sort of commonality of experience. I just want people to understand that trans people are people. And the obsession with trans women, for example, rather than trans men and intersex people, is what makes this divisive and how it just loses the humanity. There are people behind this legislation. There are people whose lives, hundreds of thousands of us, whose lives are being changed, whose rights are being eroded. And we're good people with good, wholesome jobs and lives and families.
Are there ways, one last question really, are there ways in which the law could recognise the vulnerability of disabled women without changing the basis on which only people female from birth could claim protection from the law in gender-based cases?
Really, the way that would happen is an amendment to the Equality Act, which made it clear that for the purposes of equalities legislation, transgender people, and we need to bear in mind that there's men and women here because trans men who are assigned female at birth and are now living as men, they look like men. And so if they're compelled into female spaces, there's an argument that because they literally look like men walking into female spaces, they give more credibility to the ability of predatory cis men to pretend to be trans men and have to enter these spaces. So my first thought is to say that from the legislative point of view, this argument isn't about legislation as much as it's about anti-trans propaganda. But if the Equality Act was amended to say that sex includes those people who have transitioned to live in an acquired gender, then that's all it would need to say. And people need to stop with the hate. That would make a difference too.
Natalie, thank you very much indeed. And that's it for today. Do let us have your reactions to anything that you've heard there. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk or leave voice messages for us on 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings, goodbye.